Hello.
You usually have a much nicer recorder.
Oh, all right. But,
like a dedicated audio recorder. We get microphones and stuff. But that's what can happen when you come to Sydney.
But then I'll say exactly the same thing, and that will be boring.
Do you think? You would say the same thing?
I kind of spend my life saying various versions of the same thing over and over. The problem is going to be not to allow me to do that. So there's your challenge.
All right. Yeah. Let's begin. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Wombat Radio. Today we're in KL. We're speaking with Bilkis. Do you have anything else you would like to say in way of introduction to yourself? It's audio. You can't shake your head.
I know. No, I don't think so.
Okay. Okay.
You can go ahead and tease it out of me.
Okay. Well, let's just start by the big one, hey?
Mm.
What are you busy with?
At the moment, actually, absolutely nothing.
Beautiful.
Tell you what I was just busy with.
Yeah, and then, like, how that fits together with all the things that you're busy with.
That I was busy with?
Yeah.
Okay. I just had the Southeast Asian Choreo Lab, which was a meeting of regional emerging contemporary dance choreographers. This is the third year I've done it as producer, and it's sort of my favorite project every year. I think partly because it's so easy to do. Funders really like it.
Because they understand it?
Because it's like a no-brainer. You bring together emerging choreographers who would never have a chance to meet each other otherwise under the guidance and mentorship of a more experienced choreographer from either Japan or Germany or the UK or wherever else funders come from. And they have a wonderful time, and it can be a sort of seminal experience in their career, and who doesn't want to fund that? Also, it's very cheap. That always helps. So hopefully we'll do it again next year. I struggle a bit with running Choreo Labs just because it's always difficult to tell whether or not you're having any kind of impact.
Yeah.
And even later, how to quantify that at all. So sometimes I think, oh, they came, they had a nice time, they met each other, they seem to have formed friends for life. That's sweet. That's enough. Now they have a network of their peers in the region, and surely that's incredibly useful to see them through the rest of their careers, or at least be the beginning of something. And during the event, all the choreographers are always very excitable, and they always say, oh yes, we're going to come back really soon, and we're going to do this, that, and the other, and we're going to work together, and we're going to do this. And in my experience, generally doesn't happen. But that's okay.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean that it won't happen in the long run. Or it may mean that I need to form some kind of facilitation of these projects happening.
Yeah.
Which is what I'm thinking of now, how to do that. How to bring people back who've already been at Rimbundahan, been in residence, know what it's like to live there, so they don't have to spend that initial time just getting used to the place. And actually have them make something that means something to their creative lives, rather than having the Choreo Lab being something slightly outside their usual practice and a respite and a vacation from themselves, have it actually be something deeply embedded in what they do. That will be step two, and I'm not sure what to do or how to achieve that, but maybe.
I think it's a weird thing that we're instantly connectable to so many people around the world, but only if you've already met them in the flesh, and then it's not a weird thing to call them. And so that's, I don't know, it's something like building in the habit of calling each other.
Mm.
Because even, like, Skype is really awkward.
I hate Skype.
So I remember there was somebody that I, so at a dance web in Impulse Towns, and there were quite a few people that I grew quite an amount of love for professionally and personally, and it still felt like I was possibly intruding when I saw them online and I just pressed the call button and I hadn't emailed first to ask and set up like a conference meeting or business. And it's a weird thing. The thing that you were talking about before with wondering about impact of that activity, I have the same wonder about dance and choreography in general. So it seems like we're wondering about the same thing. But the thing that you're doing is facilitating to make happen the thing that I'm thinking about. So you're like, does my facilitation have an impact? And then I'm like, well, is what you facilitated to eventually then get made to happen have an impact?
Yeah, is art worth anything at all, though, is where you're going at the end of this sentence.
Yeah, I guess it's a nice framework for reminding yourself how little you know sometimes. I mean, it's a nice excuse to come together outside of a church or a wedding or a mosque. I really like coming together to be together without discussion, to be together without words or without talking or without explicit shared experience.
So like when a bunch of choreographers gets together in the studio, you find that experience.
I don't know, but then also you could do the same. You could just go bushwalking and not talk to each other while you're hiking over the mountain because you're too exhausted, or you could go scuba diving together. So in some ways I think it's endlessly important to keep reconsidering the world and ourselves and the stories we tell ourselves from an embodied place.
But how that embodied self really expresses itself is not always through dance or what we think of as dance. And I always think with the Choreo Lab, they have the best time and the most effective in a way time when I leave them alone and they don't have scheduled activities and they go down and sit by the pool and drink beer and have karaoke, which they did on this occasion, and then recorded themselves on video and blasted it over YouTube of them all doing surprisingly good Bharatanatyam to Bollywood music all together, even though most of them had never studied Bharatanatyam in their lives, which was hilarious. And I sometimes, because I suppose I've been in that same situation where you get invited to Korea or, you know, the UK or whatever, and you're ostensibly supposed to be going to do a certain thing, speak on a panel, discuss a topic. But what you really go to do is to meet people and to hear about how cool they are and to make friends, networks, assets.
Yeah.
And really what you talk about at the panel doesn't have any impact on you necessarily. So the structure of the event is just the peg that you hang the socializing on. And it's the unplanned, unplannable things that happen in and around those pegs that you want to sort of allow to happen. Or at least that's my belief. Possibly self-serving, possibly just because I want to abdicate responsibility for the outcome of this Choreo Lab. Like, it's not up to me, it's up to them to make also, these mystical connections.
There's something about connection through history as well, not just now. Like, we're not just connected to now because you brought us all together. Us, I'm talking about people.
In general,
yeah, like, we're already connected through history. We're being brought together by economic systems and to discuss and understand and relate to each other through what is basically a colonizing format of art creation, which has been spread by colonizers. So there's... It just seems really juicy and unspoken, all of that stuff as well. Like, why should the Philippines have the art practice that has anything to do with...
This France. Is the post-colonial situation, though.
Well, I just don't know about post. Like,
no, but post always implies... I don't know, the post-colonial discourse implies the continuity of, I think, more than the postness of it. The idea that in our supposedly post-colonial world, these things still resonate, are still somehow powerful and effective.
Perhaps it's a simple thing with, it's a similar thing with post-Coriolab discourse.
Post-Coriolab discourse, yes. Coriolab will always be with you. Insidious power. That'd be nice. That made me feel much better about myself. Yeah, I don't know. But then I look at other people's Coriolabs when I feel uncertain about my own, and I don't feel more reassured by theirs. Which, well, okay, is not a very high bar, maybe, but...
It's the only reason we do anything is because we think that the structures that already exist could be better. And so we look around hoping for the person that's going to do that, and they're not there, and so you got to do it. Which goes from, like, who's going to mash the potatoes to, like, who's going to cook the rice. And if you're lucky enough to know how to cook rice and you're with someone who just boils it and then strains it, you do it, because...
We have rice cookers. You don't have to do anything. Press the button. Put the right amount of water in. That's key.
Yeah, that is key. Not the rinse. The rinse is pretty key sometimes.
Yeah, you can skip the rinse if you're not too squeamish about bugs. It's optional.
So there's something, like, I wonder how many other things like that that you're involved with and you do, because you're driven from this same viewpoint of, I look around and the thing that I want to be there is not there.
Yes, mostly. Also because I see... I want to feel my own usefulness in this context and this community. I'm not a dancer. I'm not a choreographer. I value dancers and choreographers and the work that they make.
That's nice.
I want to see them make more of it under the circumstances that would allow them to make work that they find more fulfilling. And if I am able to do that, then that embeds me within a network of meaning, which gives me personal validity, which otherwise I wouldn't have. So to make myself useful, I must do useful things.
Amen.
Sometimes I wonder if I'm doing the most useful things, but like we all do.
I'm always wondering that.
Yeah, that's okay. I don't think of myself as being particularly visionary. I don't, or original. So a lot of the times I depend on other people saying, oh, this would be a great thing to do. And then I think, oh, yes, that would be a great thing to do. And I'll do it. Which is fine. I think that's okay.
How do you choose who to listen to?
Who to listen or what to do? Yeah. Mostly just through availability of resources, I think, and achievability.
Yeah.
I have very strict limitations and... Some things are easier to achieve than others, so that kind of sorts itself out for itself.
Yeah.
In the long term, there should be a better system of coming at it and really thinking like, okay, I must be more systematic and directed about this. But
maybe that's just the myth of linearity and logic progression.
Maybe, but it may also have something to do with achieving something bigger and more long term.
You know what that might be?
What?
The bigger long-term thing? Do you have any idea on what that could be?
Not really.
No, me neither.
I skirt around the issues of greater financial stability, and especially with My Dance Alliance, which is the support organization, because it's a non-profit organization and it's run by a volunteer committee, and occasionally we all get together to do a big festival, and then most of the time we don't do anything. And wouldn't it be great if we had more or any operational funding so that we could not have, or at least that I would not have to do the 1,001 tiny secretarial tasks that take up a lot of my time that would free me to do higher level work. And then I think of all the grant applications I would have to do, which probably wouldn't eventuate in anything, in order to get that money in order to hire a secretary. And I think, well, maybe I'd rather just do tiny things myself. And then I look at Ausdance, which for so long has been, from my perspective, kind of this beacon of possibility in terms of what can be achieved by working with a long-term plan and having ideas about succession planning and sustainability and good governance, and then your government changes and they make a decision that cuts your legs out from under you, and what are you going to do? All the plans that you've made mean nothing. So do you really want to devote your lives to that when it's kind of so intangible and so fragile? Or do you have to, at some point, you know, bet the money that you have with the understanding that you might fail, but you might get operational funding at the end of the day? That surely would be a good thing. I don't know.
One of the things that it's... that I'm most excited about that at any point in time existence of Ausdance for is that there's a lot of dance in schools now. There's a lot, there's some recognition that you can study dance and physicality and become literate in your body, and that that is, if not as valid, at least valid enough to be marked as part of a curriculum field of endeavor and investigation. And so in some way, once I get to a professional level, I'm like, well, I need a support network framing all of my efforts. I think I look to someone like that and I think, what are you doing? But then I realize that there's a whole generation of people that have knowledge that would not have been given to them, in the same way, like you said, that like the things that happen are the things that can happen. And so maybe change just takes a long time, like generations of time.
Yeah, and it's not permanent either when it happens.
Yeah,
as you know, in Australia you have had achievements, you've had funding, and that doesn't mean that you always get that. You have to keep defending that turf again and again and again. And that's exhausting to think of, also. And
distracting as well.
And distracting and kind of miserable making.
Okay.
But, yeah. Do you think it's installation art?
Depends how long it goes for.
If there are multiple people on multiple rooftops. Oh, this could be exciting. Yeah. Or do you think it's just yoga?
I think the separation between someone just hanging out and some kind of something that's been designed for us to watch is like a hint to an author. And if there were more than one person, we'd be like, all right, there's an author at work.
Because you would see the design of it.
Yeah.
But and that doesn't necessarily mean that it's not designed for watching, just because there's one person.
No, it just means that we're not being reassured and reminded that it is.
So then you feel somehow morally culpable.
And you're like, oh, am I... Yeah.
That's fantastic! Oh, wow.
So for listeners, there's somebody about our age on a building across the road that caught our eye because they were jumping and then took off their flannelette top to reveal some kind of singlet top, and now has disappeared on the rooftop except for arms.
Which
that emerge. Are being silhouetted by the sky.
Yeah.
And these arms just emerge as some kind of hand puppets or...
They're, now they've disappeared now. Entirely.
I think the wonder that it has incited is the thing that excites me the most.
Oh, they are again. Back. Pseudo belly dancing arms.
Do you think she's standing or lying down?
I think she's standing because I think she's behind a wall. So sometimes she raises her arms in the air and we can see them, and sometimes she doesn't. A woman doing belly dance alone on a rooftop in Chinatown.
Mm. Who appears European.
Who appears European.
Oh. Maybe she's stretching.
Maybe it is some waving or drowning.
Yes.
Mm. Yes.
Waving or drowning is a beautiful way to explain Australia's response to governmental changes and funding changes.
Waving or drowning can be used to explain anything. At any time.
Do you think that there's a pinpoint or a choreo lab is just one aspect? But then there's a whole bunch of other things that you do as well.
Choreo lab is one aspect, but I feel like it's the one that I want to do most because it's the one that's most directly about connecting the region.
Mm.
And I think that's what needs to be done.
Mm.
Mostly because of the dominant systems of patronage and power. The connections that we constantly have are with previously colonial governments and or Axis powers, who, for whatever reason, find it important to perpetuate some kind of soft power diplomacy in this region, and so are able to give us lots of money. But the result then is that you spend more time working with artists from Berlin and Tokyo and London than you do working with artists from Phnom Penh or Yogyakarta, just because both you and the people in Yogyakarta don't have any money, so you're not able to facilitate those connections.
Mm.
So one of the ways to perhaps upset the balance of power is to enable those connections to happen and then to support whatever comes out of those connections, even if the initial project is funded, supported by the Axis powers. I think that's fine.
I think that's great.
It's like people getting the Rhodes Scholarship, right? You know where the money comes from. But then again, you'll take it if you're final project is to be destabilizing that situation. Maybe. Yeah, so I want to do more projects like Choreo Lab, but because of the financial situation, it's always a little bit difficult to figure out how to do that, how to mobilize other funders to pay for what you really want to do, and isn't that everybody's problem all the time?
Yes.
Hmm. But I think Southeast Asia is going through a moment of being a little bit sexy for funders. So that's always useful to take advantage of. And I think also we're going through an unprecedented level of being more connected to each other because of social media or because of regional events and festivals and
budget airlines.
Budget airlines are a big deal. No small thing, budget airlines. No. How would we survive without them?
I think someone said to me once about $2 shops really bolstering up contemporary performance and contemporary installation.
Because the number of strange things that you can buy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think budget airlines are that.
Budget are the $2 shops.
The $2 shops of
regional arts networking. Yep. I will second that. Couldn't do it without AirAsia. No. Thanks, AirAsia.
It's costing me half as much to go KL to Melbourne as it would from Darwin to Sydney.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's about right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but where to go from here?
That's a good question.
I don't know.
I didn't even have to ask it.
Yeah, I don't know. Because also, putting choreographers with choreographers is not necessarily part of their practice, right? You want to put choreographers with performers or with composers, designers, whatever.
And then also with heads of state and with urban planners and with architects
and scientists
and nurses and augmented reality technicians.
That would be very cool.
Yeah, it's a project I'm doing later this year.
Yeah. I just met a New Zealand choreographer who does stuff with Weta Workshop, and I was like, oh, so cool. That.
So, is that what you're going to do?
That's what I want to do, is to figure out how to do that. I have another Access Powers plan.
Yes.
Which is to bring a German choreographer named Isabel Schad to Malaysia, to Rimbundahan, and to assemble for her a massive cast of like 20 people from the region to learn this dance that she's made and perform it. The work is called, oh no, what's it called? Critical Jumps or something like that. It has a terrible name, but it's a very compelling work, which is done in a very large ensemble with everyone on stage and not going off stage. And the premise of the work is that they have a sequence of movements, which they have to progress through in a linear fashion, and they cannot deviate from. But each person gets to decide when they want to move from doing one thing to the next thing.
Mm.
And those movements are akin to, or she wants the dancers to think of them as, warm-up movements. So in the same way, kind of dictated by your body, you make the decision of whether or not you've done it one movement enough for your body. Has your body done that enough that you're willing to move on to the next movement? So when you see it being performed, you can sit back and watch this ensemble of 25 people in a very organic manner move in and out of these patterns that are created from this linear sequence of movements. Or you can hone in on a particular dancer and see them physically thinking their way through this sequence and making these decisions one by one, which is, it's just incredible. Like, watching it was while I was watching it, I thought how wonderful it would be to be one of those dancers, because you can see the effect of it in their bodies. And then I thought, I want a whole bunch of Southeast Asian choreographers to do this so that they can feel this. And not so that they can make anything like it, but just so that they can have this amazing experience, which I feel would in some way affect their lives. And also, you know, again, spend like a month living together at Rimbundahan and doing karaoke in the evenings.
Yes. Great.
But that's as far as I've got with that plan, taking over the world.
Do you think, so I just had a crazy idea, Broome in northwestern Australia was exempt from the White Australia policy.
Mm.
And full also, primarily, yeah, yes. The pearl industry. Do you think places like Broome or Darwin or the Torres Straits, places that are within 2 hours boat ride of places that are Southeast Asia, could ever consider themselves to also be Southeast Asia? They're connected to Southern Anglo-Australia by landmass, but not by distance or temperature or even food.
Or language.
Or language.
Yeah.
They're also connected by money.
Yes, and by legality.
Yeah.
And
by
all sorts and all of other things.
But I wonder about that.
No, definitely. But I mean, I think...
It's a very small change on a map.
Yeah. I think Australia's always, white Australia anyway, has always felt like it struggled with its position in Asia as being part of Asia.
Yeah.
And to me it seemed, a little bit either limited in its viewpoint or sort of disingenuous, because there are parts of Australia that, yeah, damn right, they're part of Asia. Like, they're full of Asians.
Yeah.
And so, of course you're part of Asia. Yeah. What else would you be? And increasingly full of Asians. So maybe as that goes on, Australia will have less inner conflict about this. Or maybe more inner conflict about this. Who knows?
I think there's an interesting thing where somehow white Australia gets placed in between Indigenous Australia and migrant Australia.
Mm.
And white Australia doesn't consider itself migrant.
Mm.
And Indigenous Australia, it has enough battles to fight itself to not consider itself migrant at some point, tens of thousands of years ago. And so there's a weird trio that is far more nuanced. But I also wonder about, there's an excellent comedy podcast by Damien Power, and he talks about how as soon as everybody stopped consuming the same mass media in Australia, Australia would splinter off into regions, and they would start to have regional identities and cultures and rituals and language, and they would stop believing that they are all Australian. And all this holding us together is probably currency and mass media that we all watch.
SBS.
Yeah, and that everybody watches Neighbours or whatever the bad show is. And so I really think, like, if that ever happens, then instantly Darwin, Broome, Cairns, a bunch of those places become, in their self-identity, part of Southeast Asia. But maybe not, because I can't speak on behalf of the Indigenous people who are of that land.
Mm.
I mean, it's a weird thing to think of what is now a nation in Southeast Asia also being once small pockets of regional peoples and identities and languages.
Yes, the nation is a very recent phenomenon and still sits rather uncomfortably in many Southeast Asian countries. Still doesn't make a lot of sense to a lot of people. And we still have to do so much work here to support the idea that nations exist. I mean, the work is so hard that sometimes it's sort of laughable how obvious it is, like what governments do to instill a sense of nationalism just because we don't naturally have it. It's just sometimes so crude, and you're like, really? I'm supposed to buy this? But
like a magician in training.
Yeah. Sometimes it has to be crude for the masses. I don't know. It has to be somewhat mainstream. But I guess what's surprising is that it doesn't work in a lot of ways. We don't think of ourselves as being from the nation we are from. We still think of ourselves as being part of language groups or smaller geographic entities. Ethnicities.
Mm. I think contemporary dance is interesting in that way, that it's spread itself so far and thin and somehow not diversified, because it doesn't seem to be a dance of the people. It's not a folk dance. It's not a celebratory dance. It's not a ritualed dance that you can partake in without money. And so somehow it's spread so many places and indoctrinated, as ballet has, so many people, and yet doesn't seem to be cultural identity in all of those places. There still is a folk dance or a dance that was there before the nation.
Well, but then do contemporary dancers think of themselves as part of a community of contemporary dancers? I think they do.
Yeah.
And you meet another contemporary dancer, or someone who self-identifies as a contemporary dancer on the other side of the world, and you know nothing about them, and yet you automatically feel some sense of connection. And
that's true. I guess it's the same with breakdance.
Yeah.
You meet a breaker and you know the ritual.
Mm. But I think contemporary dance is more difficult for that because it's so diverse.
Yeah.
Because it's so difficult. That there may be rituals for breakdance, but what are those rituals really for contemporary dance? Because it could be anything.
Hopefully it could be anything, but more often than not, it has to look like it's contemporary dance.
Well, what does contemporary dance look like?
Well,
it has to be on a stage.
Usually, yeah.
But it's often not on a stage.
Exactly.
So that's not... I mean, it doesn't have any defining characteristics that are always applicable. It doesn't have a single ritual of practice.
Yeah, which is weird, though, because something like independent rock that became indie rock that became a genre, and then modern dance that became contemporary dance that became... Somehow it's become a genre. And yet still is so shitty to define.
Well, and in a way, it has the kind of limited definition of someone who does this particular technique of Western-derived movement, which still owes a lot to ballet.
I have a theory that ballet just recolonized it. And I couldn't stop it from emerging, and so just recolonized it after it had emerged.
But then you attribute rationality to ballet. And some kind of life force. I don't know if we can do that.
Yeah.
No, but I mean, contemporary dance in Southeast Asia can look like that.
Yeah.
And can look nothing like that.
How exciting.
Maybe. I don't know.
See, that woman on that roof was doing contemporary dance. Nah.
Yeah. So sometimes I think that that I'm willing to be very accepting about contemporary dance and think if you self-identify as a contemporary dancer, then you are a contemporary dancer. That no one can tell you otherwise because we don't have a very good definition for it. I spent several days in a discussion community with a bunch of mid-career female artists who were trying to make happen a new label for conceptual contemporary performance work so that it wasn't couched under contemporary dance. So that it could have its own identity beyond the idea of the Western ballet-derived technique. And we all agreed that it was a very good idea and it should really, really should happen. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah, I wonder the same thing about just even the naming system.
Yeah.
Or the training system. The idea of embracing diversity, but then also the idea of expecting some kind of standard.
Some kind of technique. And, a degree of ability and virtuosity.
And a shared language.
Yeah. No. Oh, often not the case.
What's your biggest hope? For all these efforts.
In terms of dance?
Well, no, just the efforts that you're putting into making things happen. The people that you're supporting, the people that you're condemning.
But for a little while we may be able to hold back the barbarians at the gates. And that... Yeah, that's my biggest hope.
That's really nice.
To be part of the fight. Just for a little while. Yeah.
Did you know that it was the barbarians that invented pants?
Pants?
So they could ride their horses.
Oh. Well, see, were they really barbarians?
Well, according to the Greeks, they were.
Mongols, yeah. Well, in a way, they were barbarians. But they weren't barbarians like the Visigoths were barbarians. Probably they were more barbaric. I mean, the Mongols had music. Did the Visigoths have music? I guess they did, I don't know. And felt.
Whoa.
And yay, felt. Made of mashed together goat hair. What civilization? But yes.
It seems like the power that we have is that we are comfortable enough with civilization to be able to utilize it towards questioning it and destabilizing it.
I don't know. I don't know that I'm destabilizing civilization. We haven't had enough of it here to want to destabilize it.
Hmm.
We haven't. We're not in that position of luxury.
Hmm.
For us, the line between civilization and barbarism is still very present and very dangerous. Very relevant. Increasingly so.
And the best way to live with that is with art.
Yeah, no, probably not.
But it's what we do anyway.
Yeah, it seems like a good idea. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe just in the way that art makes you... puts you in a state of not understanding and compels you to try and find understandings so that you never feel comfortable about the way that you think. And maybe complacency is the enemy of civilization.
That's why I talk to you, Vilkas, for the wisdom.
What time is it? You have to go.
Thank you.
7 o'clock. 3 minutes to...